Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Really nice to have you with us. A great pleasure to have you here. It was a very hot weekend, but we are hoping that you are staying cool in some way, and maybe that includes your car, maybe that includes an air conditioner or a fan or some energy efficient way of staying cool, laying in a cold bathtub or a pool. Whatever it is, we really don't care as long as you have the radio on. So, and by God, don't, you know, do we have to tell people not to put a corded object near their pool or bathtub?
I think it's always worth a reminder.
I always feel that when I'm told that they're talking down to me, but then yet you hear about the person who brought the radio to them. Yeah.
Okay, but what about a like a cell phone that does not have a cord on it?
That's a great question, Alan. I don't think
it would cause electrocution. I think it would destroy your cell phone.
Yeah, it would destroy your cell phone.
Well, I remember once at the very beginning when I first got it, you know, I was doing what comes naturally, and I leaned over and the thing fell into the toilet bowl. And so I
Thanks for sharing. And I went to the guy.
The store. It happens all the time.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I know we had a similar incident with one of my nephew's phones, and we went into the store, and the guy said, we average about 20 of these a week.
Wow.
Yeah, so there
Mostly
you go.
Mostly men?
Yes. Women are smarter.
Yeah, this is true. Thank you very much for that vote of confidence.
All right, let's introduce the group and we'll get started. Alan Shartok is here. We're just talking to him. Good morning, sir. Good to have you here.
Good morning, Joseph. Always fun to get out there and see what's going on.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have a lot, and we'll get to it in just a minute. We welcome Libby Post to the program. She was with us Friday. She's with us today.
Hi.
We're lucky we get you like two days, not in a row, but
we are so lucky.
We really love having you here. So good to have you here. Let's see. Oh, look, Sarah Rogerson is with us, Albany Law School professor, director of the Immigration Law Clinic, our dear friend. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you.
Say something legal.
Res ipsa loquitur.
Of course, there is that.
Yeah.
The thing speaks for itself.
Let's also welcome Jennifer Burns, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning, Jennifer. A delight to have you. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. We really appreciate you taking the time out. All right. Well, we have a lot to talk about. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll get started. If you have any thoughts on any of the subjects that we are talking about, please share them with us, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's go to the items for today, and there's a lot to talk about. I think we'll start off, however, with the infrastructure deal because of what happened over the weekend. And I don't know. I don't know how much to make of this. I don't know what to make necessarily about this. It just is odd. But here we go. President Biden appears to have salvaged a nearly $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure deal after 2 days of uncertainty in which GOP lawmakers took issue with remarks by Biden suggesting he would not sign the agreement unless it was linked with another proposal that included some more spending for other Democratic priorities. In interviews Sunday, several Republican lawmakers resumed an optimistic tone, predicting the bipartisan infrastructure bill would be successful. But only after Biden issued a lengthy statement Saturday asserting that his comments on Friday had not amounted to a veto threat. Mitt Romney, the Republican senator from Utah, formerly the Republican from the state of Massachusetts, said, I do trust the president. He said this on CNN's State of the Union, and he made very clear in the much larger statement that came out over the weekend, carefully crafted and thought through piece by piece, that if the infrastructure bill reaches his desk and it comes alone, he will sign it. On Thursday, this is when all the trouble began. On Thursday, shortly after triumphantly denouncing the Democrats and Republicans had reached a, not denouncing, announcing.
Announcing.
Yes, thank you, Libby. Had reached an agreement on the $973 billion package. Biden told reporters he would sign it only in tandem with his American Families Plan, a separate bill that includes spending on items Democrats have argued are also critical infrastructure, such as child care and clean energy investments. If this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it, Biden said then. It's in tandem. Biden's remarks prompted uproar by GOP lawmakers who said they were blindsided and accused Biden of carrying out a bait and switch. Some Democrats said Republicans should have known all along they intended to pursue comprehensive infrastructure investments on two separate tracks. Well, on Saturday, the president walked back his remarks somewhat, saying he had not intended to issue a veto threat and that he intended to support the infrastructure plan without reservation or hesitation. Our bipartisan agreement does not preclude Republicans from attempting to defeat my family's plan. Likewise, they should have no objections to my devoted efforts to pass the family's plan and other proposals in tandem. We will let the American people and the Congress decide. The bottom line is this. I gave my word to support the infrastructure plan. That's what I intend to do. I fully stand behind it without reservation or hesitation. Biden emphasized he would continue to pursue his family's plan and other Democratic spending priorities through the budget reconciliation process, which would avoid a GOP filibuster. On Sunday, Senator Rob Portman, he's from Ohio, you know, and a Republican, who is among the group of 10 senators who crafted the bipartisan agreement, said on ABC this week that he was glad to see the president clarify his remarks. Portman said, quite frankly, we were all blindsided by the comments the previous day, which were that these two bills were connected. Okay. Alan?
This is the Times? We're
accidentally on purpose or what?
Mm. Well, no. Look, the guy had a victory. And the victory was he's the president. He was going to get the credit for getting this infrastructure bill through. So he also has a left group in the Congress of the United States who promised their people that they would do more for them, and he gave them an acknowledgement. But he's not going to give up a big win, because it's going to be his win that we get the infrastructure bill. And in fact, I think anything else to the contrary, any hint to the contrary, defeats his own politics and his own purposes. So I think, you know, it's clear. Now, if they want to go ahead and pass a separate bill with 51 votes, assuming Arizona, you know, and West Virginia go along with it, then that'll be a different story and he can do it. But I think it was not good politics to pull the rug out from under the Republicans, to be honest with you.
Jennifer Burns, do you think he really meant to keep the two in tandem, or that maybe he just didn't get the briefing note?
I think it was a little bit of a slip of the tongue. I think in his mind, they are in tandem. And I think he and other Democrats are trying to figure out how to make sure the family plan, which they're seeing as the human infrastructure, is also going to get through and be intact, because right from the start, the two have been linked. Jobs, infrastructure in the physical sense and in broadband, but then also how do you take care of families and getting people jobs, but then also for internet and childcare. So I think it was a bit of a slip of the tongue there. But I also think there's still a lot of nothing's really a done deal here. I mean, that's the key to all of this. Nothing's done. And how this money is really going to be spent and where the money's coming from, with Republicans saying that they are not going to go for anything that has to do with increasing taxes on the rich, is going to be a major problem.
Given the fragility of all of this, Libby, and the fact that you have the president desperately needing the 10 Republican senators, getting the 10 Republican senators, and then screwing up in perhaps losing them, what it didn't help things.
You know, there's a part of me.
Remember, this is the radio. You just can't make.
Yeah, I know. Faces. I know. You can't just. I know. It's not TV. There's a part of me that, yes, I mean, he's prone to gaffes. We know that. The only reason, I'm not the only reason, but the reason why Obama was forced to come on board with marriage equality when he did was because Joe went on the air and said he was in favor of it. So, you know, and that was a little premature for the Obama folks. But not a bad problem. Huh?
But not a bad problem.
Yeah, not a bad problem to have. But be that as it may, he is prone to misspeaking, but I also think, you know, this was an opportunity for him to say what he said, give the progressives some juice, give the Republicans the opportunity to crank and say, look, we won. We got him back to where we wanted him to be. And so, and that's in my little Machiavellian mind.
But it does show bipartisanship.
Yeah, right. I mean, he's been talking about bipartisanship the entire time. For that to be just a slip of the tongue was just a little too deliberate, because no one had been saying the two were linked. We all want the two to be linked, but the agreement was that they weren't. And so for him to say that, I think there was some calculation there to give the Republicans a look of a win in all of this.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, I agree with Libby. We're used to a slip of the tongue president that puts people in chaos. So we're just a little too prone to those types of, you know, write-offs, but this is a different presidency. This is a tightly controlled White House. This is a White House with a clear message and as you mentioned, Joe, like a very delicate negotiation process. I think he was trying to push I think they were testing the waters. I think they were, and we were coming off of a vote earlier last week, I think it was, where the Voting Rights Act was filibustered. Do I have that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm getting all of my weeks confused. I'm still in COVID time. Nothing was really lining up correctly. But, you know, that all happened the same within close proximity of each other. And so there might have been a little flexing going on, you know, like, this is my White House and this is our house. And we've been doing all manner of crazy things for you and your president for 4 years, and now it's time for us to do adult responsible things, and we want to see how far we can push you.
And Alan,
because the Republicans are acting like petulant teenagers.
Yes.
So what else is new?
Isn't it, and we also sort of can tell, at least this was my read on it, that this happened, Friday? There was back and forth on Saturday, and by the Sunday morning talk shows, the Republicans, who were the 10 in the room, or the five in the room, right, were all saying, yeah, this isn't a problem. So you assume it wasn't really that big of an issue if it was handled that quickly.
Yeah, well, you make a very good point. And to me, it was fairly clear that they weren't going to give up on the deal, that those five weren't going to give up on the deal. Now, we still have Mitch McConnell and all the damage that he can do. We still have Trump in the background, leaning on the Republicans not to do it. In fact, he was at a place giving a speech for an opponent to one of the guys who had voted, a Republican who had voted to convict him, voted to impeach him. Those people had already announced and put themselves into danger. They weren't going to let it go, and he wasn't going to double cross them.
So what do we look for, do you think, over the next couple of days?
Mitch.
See what Mitch has to say.
We have to see how crazy that whole thing gets.
Go ahead, Libby.
Well, I think... Go ahead.
Go ahead, Libby. No, you go.
Okay. Thanks.
I know you go.
Okay. I think Mitch will crank, but he's got 10 members who want this. And he's got more than 10 members who want this. Let's be honest. There's a lot of Republicans who want this because there's a lot of people in their districts who want this.
Yeah, but Libby, there comes that point when they say, okay, The people in my district want it. We know that. We know that on a lot of levels. People in their district want gun control. The people in their district want this, but they still are scared of the guy, and they don't want to lose their offices. And that's where the rubber hits the road.
True, but this is also about jobs.
Jennifer?
Yeah, but that's, I mean, that's focused really on the Republican side of things. When
that's
we look
right.
at the Democratic side of things, you know, we still have Pelosi, we still have Schumer, we still have the progressives. And what this comment by Biden, you know, we're looking at how it's reflected upon or what the Republicans are dealing with, which was very quick. In a few days, they were kind of over it. But what about AOC and other progressives? The Democratic Party is having a little bit of turmoil here over these two things being connected or separate. And so what did Biden's comment or slip of the tongue, however we look at it, mean for the Democratic Party?
That's another great point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are they, how are they feeling about it? Because you made the Republicans now at least breathe a sigh of relief.
But it may be a double, triple, quadruple fake out.
Oh,
no,
I love
kidding.
One then. Yeah.
We're not sure. We're not sure whether he wasn't doing something to bring the left in with him at the same time, say, oh, yeah, well, I misspoke. But it gave them something, if you think about it that way.
Yeah. Sarah?
I agree with everybody.
Okay. you made that very simple.
That's dangerous. Alec,
sweet. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll return. We have much more to discuss, many more topics, and all kinds of stuff. We'll get to it all. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan, Libby, Sarah, and Jennifer. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson. We have letters on talking about the infrastructure bill, on our talking about the infrastructure bill. And we go to Joe, who starts off very nicely and says, thanks for being awesome. Well, thank you.
Wow.
Hi, and sorry to not dive into the bill myself, but you're experts, so I might as well ask. Okay, well, we play experts. We try.
On TV, too.
Yeah, that's right. Does the compromise infrastructure bill, which is being touted as physical infrastructure-focused, contain meaningful investment in clean energy, both grid-scale and residential? That, to me, is so crucial at this point in time. And I know the GOP hates anything that acknowledges the dangers of global warming. I think this is one of the things that is not part of this particular package. Am I right? Yes.
But I think everybody woke up this morning and said, here it is.
Right.
You know, I got to walk outside at 4 o'clock in the morning and it's over 70 or 75 degrees.
Well, and of course, this is anecdotal, but for those of us who are Olympic nerds, the Olympic trials were supposed to end last night with the men and women's gymnastics team being named, but it didn't because they had to postpone the track and field competition and trials in Oregon, where it was 117 degrees.
In Eugene.
Oh, my God. Yeah. They were very nice, and because they didn't want the runners to die, they decided.
Nice,
yeah, I thought so. They did it. They did it at night. So where it was a balmy 97. So
you believe that?
Man. Okay. So thank you, Joe, for that note. We go to Dave, who says, no, no, no. The Republicans rolled themselves on this. McConnell's caucus was depending on Democrats in disarray to foul up passage of the reconciliation larger product everyone knew was coming. Because Pelosi and Schumer were successful in whipping their caucus into consensus, that didn't happen. Holy disingenuousness. Holy disingenuousness.
Disingenuous.
MSM thoughtlessly adopted the GOP faux outrage talking pants. Bad, bad journalist. What is MSM? I'm sorry. Anybody?
MS?
It's MSM. Which I knew.
Mainstream media.
Oh, it's mainstream media.
It also has another meaning.
In classified, as I believe it's men seeking men,
or
right?
Or men having sex with men. Right.
Okay.
I don't think that's what he means.
I know that from the Metroland days.
Yeah, right. I remember that.
Okay. we'll assume it's mainstream media. Thank you, Sarah, for that clarification. Sure. The letter would have taken a completely different tone otherwise. Barry says, I, for one, am hugely, which will remind you not if you can spell things out, that has helpful to us.
Yeah, you always tell them not to do that.
I know. They have.
And they just not doing what you tell them.
Meanings. Barry said, I, for one, am hugely concerned and disappointed that more significant climate change content, this is to the earlier letter too, is not in the current bill. As shown by today's weather here and out west, severe climate effects are happening now. Infrastructure in the old sense isn't happening, isn't helping. We don't need new roads and bridges. We do need upgraded electrical transmission and renewable energy. I think we could argue we need both, right? But
I would.
We also need an equitable transition to a climate-safe future. As far as I'm concerned, not passing any Infrastructure Act is better than boosting urban sprawl and fossil fuel use. Okay. I get the point, but it's hard to... Sheila says, imagine if we could get politicians to dig in their heels for the benefit of the poor with the same level of intensity that the Republicans have for the benefit of the rich. Wouldn't that be something to see?
Mm-hmm.
Then we have this letter from Dave. Oh, did I read this one already? Yes, I did read this one. That was the MSM letter. Okay. So that is what we have on those subjects. Let's move on, and we'll talk for a moment before we have to go to a break in just a few minutes. And that is the fourth day now has ended as authorities continue a search for condo victims. This story get sadder and sadder with each day. Yes. Police on Sunday night identified four more people who died after the Champlain Tower South condominiums collapsed Thursday, a grim end to a fourth day of searching for survivors. Nine people were confirmed dead Sunday night, including four whom the Miami-Dade Police Department identified publicly. Officials have accounted for 134 of the building's residents and are looking for information about an estimated 150 others. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levin-Cava stressed that these numbers are not final. The search and rescue mission will continue, and emergency workers have brought in machinery to sift through the debris, which will be taken to a warehouse and analyzed for forensic clues. But, of course, as each day and each hour really goes by, the hope of finding anyone alive dwindles.
Of course, the blame game now goes on. Now, you know, somebody 10 years ago said something, 20 years ago said something. Everybody in Dade County is going to be looking at the building that they're living in. And government, doing what it's supposed to be doing, is going to be looking at what they did or should have been doing along this time. So that's what's going to happen.
Well, you know, I read that in 2015, I think, there was a report on the building, and it said it needed $8 million in repairs. And obviously that didn't happen. And so now the legal consequences of this are going to be much more than $8 million, that's for sure. Because the people who own the building, whoever, and, you know, it's a condo. So you can say, well, it was everybody's responsibility, right? But, you know, the buck's got to stop someplace, and this is just a tragedy. And it may be a tragedy waiting to happen in other buildings as well. We don't know. And I'm glad that the folks down there seem to be doing inspections now of all the various buildings where people live. But there's a lot of people living down there. And, you know, there's a lot of Orthodox Jews in this building. You know, it's just horrific. There's somebody from my hometown who lived in the building. I keep seeing this on Facebook, who graduated a year before me. So it's really just a horrible, horrible situation. And I can't imagine what it's like to be a family member waiting and waiting and waiting.
The people who got out, the stories that they're telling is that they heard two very loud booms, and then the building started to shake and rumble. Those people were able to jump out of bed, get into the room, and either go from the balcony or in the stairs and get down. Although there's also reports that it was the first floor that ultimately gave way first. Sarah.
Yeah, it's a awful, awful tragedy, and unfortunately, it's these types of large casualty property dilapidation / neglect cases that make a lot of interesting case law down the road. Mm-hmm. For all the reasons that you're mentioning, there are so many different moving pieces. I'm also glad to hear that the local authorities, not the first responders, which of course they're doing their job day and night. It just keeps bringing up, it's not the same scale, but you know, it evokes the image of 9/11 mm-hmm. and going through the rubble and trying to find survivors. And, you know, hopefully we've learned lessons from that so that the first responders are protected, you know, from any sort of emissions from the building materials, but then also thinking about the local government response and pulling all of the records for any other buildings to make sure that this management company or whoever is responsible for the maintenance is doing the right thing in other places. And unfortunately, with these like destination locations too, like Florida has become quite a, you know, it has been for a while, but increasingly so. Unfortunately, you have people just trying to put up buildings as mm-hmm. fast as they possibly can. And this is, you know, and or not maintain the existing properties they have and push right. their development money into new construction.
Well,
you know, to think that you can go from a fully erect building to right. rubble in 11 seconds.
Yeah.
And that happened basically. And that's very scary. One other thing that I had heard that I guess some of the building managers were saying this. Many this could have been far worse as far as the loss of life because many of the units were boarded up for the summer. Meaning that the snowbirds had boarded up their units exactly. and had gone north. So. You know, if there's any blessings in here, I guess that would be one of them. Jennifer.
You know, I'm so sad about it. And I guess that's just really me being human and emotional in the sense, because it really is that split second in how people may have skirted proper building guidelines, but then also in the last 40 years, what we have learned and what needs to be changed about buildings, especially in places that are along the coast with climate change and hurricanes and shifting ground and, you know, all of those sort of things. And, you know, you go to bed and that's all it takes. And I'm also, you know, thinking about what has been done in the area too for others living in nearby buildings because of the toxic fumes, because of maybe how the ground has shifted due to this, and will it reverberate? I mean, have they evacuated other buildings? What? So there's a lot, not just in the tragedy itself, but how it's going to reverberate all along this coast and in other structures, and you know how long it takes people to put out reports and investigate what happened. So it's just still so raw and horrible, and there's just so many questions still unanswered.
So many questions, so much that we don't know. As of right now, this is what we do know. Rescue teams didn't find any survivors this weekend. So the number is 9 dead. However, there are more than 150 people who are unaccounted for. We also know that engineers are now suspecting a failure at the bottom of the tower, but obviously one of the first things to do is to find the souls in that rubble in the meantime. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a couple letters on this subject. We'll move on to other subjects as well. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson, we welcome yours. We'll be right back. Libby alluded to this right before we went to break, but the details of the structural issues with the condominium building came to light over the weekend. There was a structural engineering report dated October 8th, 2018, and provided to the Champlain Towers Condominium Association. They found widespread problems that required extensive repairs, quote, in the near future. The nine-page report, authored by Morabito Consultants, listed several areas of concern with the 40-year-old building. The report detailed significant cracks and breaks in the building's concrete, which required repairs to ensure the safety of the residents and the public. There was, according to that report, major structural damage to the concrete structural slab below the pool deck caused by waterproofing that was, quote, beyond its useful life. The report also warned of abundant cracking and spalling. Does anyone know what that means? Spalling, S-P-A-L-L-I-N-G. I'll look that up. In the concrete columns, beams, and walls, earlier repairs to the garage had been done improperly, according to the report. At the time the building collapsed, work had been done on the roof only and not on the concrete restoration. I think...
Spalling means it's broken into small pieces.
Okay. All right. Okay. So a little more information on that. We go to... this letter from David. Condo associations are ill-equipped to deal with when the whole building might have to be torn down. They can push through a new roof, but they can't do assessment that says the whole building is uninhabitable. No one wants to lose their entire investment.
So I looked this up. There are many causes of concrete spalling. They include the improper placement of concrete, and it's reinforcing electrochemical reactions between embedded metals within the concrete matrix, which we all know that they do the rebar, and corrosion of embedded reinforcing steel due to exposure to water and or chemicals. So if there was a leak in the pool, right, and it's got chlorine in it, it can and seeps into the concrete with the rebar, there you go. Not that I'm an expert here, but... you can connect the dots.
Let's see. We got this one, and this is directed to you, Libby, and I read it in good faith. Okay. Good morning from Joel. Why did Libby feel the need to point out that there were a lot of Orthodox Jews living in the building? I bet there were a lot of Christians, agnostics, and atheists living in the building as well, human beings, one and all. That is true. I will add, not that you need me to help defend you, but there has been a great deal written in the Miami Herald, mm-hmm. as well as in the New York Times and the Washington Post about the residents of this facility.
Right. There's a major Orthodox community there. Right. That's why it became noticeable.
Right.
While we all want to be very careful not to, you know, point anybody out specifically like this, this is a major tragedy for that group.
Yeah, I read the foreword every morning, you know, what our grandparents used to read.
And who
and they're talking about it too.
Yeah.
All right, Kathy says, when looking at air photos of the building, the ocean is in front of the intercoastal waterway. Try it again. Take two. The ocean is in front.
Yes.
And the intercoastal waterway is behind it.
Oh, wow.
Obviously, the water table is not very far beneath the bottom of the building. When some folks came down out of the remaining tower, they came out in the parking garage, and it was flooded with a lot of water, so the sea level was rising, they say. So not only were the repairs not made, but Mother Nature is very busy as well. All right. Anybody else on that before we move on to other stories?
Keep going.
Hearing none, we go to our...
I just want to lift up one thing on the immigration side that I'm really frustrated about that we can talk about later because I feel like we're still in the recovery side of this.
But yes.
There was a piece of that article that referenced that foreign nationals were not eligible for FEMA aid. And this governor...
yeah, Ron DeSantis,
and potential presidential candidate
for the Republican Party,
right,
had better come up with a state-based aid formula rather than saying, if you're not a United States citizen, you're tough luck. And that's all I'll say about that for now.
Okay. Is that really all you want to say? Because I have a couple of questions. Do you mind fielding those questions?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So what does that mean? How would FEMA aid affect this particular situation? And what impact would it have on those living in the building?
Yeah. So there are lots of different FEMA aid formulas, and I'm not an expert on that, but what I do know is that a lot of federal funding streams and federal aid streams exclude undocumented immigrants or people who are not United States citizens, and there's a large population of that group in Florida and potentially in this building. And it's not unusual because of the way that we treat immigrants in this country on a federal level. It needs to be fixed. It's broken, yada, yada. This is another way that it's broken. States can get creative, and New York State has done a wonderful job of this. New York State is one of the first states in the country to, for example, fund civil legal services for immigrants who are facing deportation or removal from the United States. So there are lots of things that states can do that the federal government won't, regarding, you know, disaster relief and many other things that the federal government has restrictions on its spending for one reason or another, you know, because it's statutory. You can't go back in and rewrite the FEMA statute right after an event happened. I mean, I guess you could. Theoretically, that could happen, but it won't. So if the federal government has to abide by statute in releasing these funds in order, you know, to help people resettle, in order to give them, you know, we saw a lot of FEMA mismanagement post Katrina. It's usually after, you know, large scale disasters that FEMA funds can be used for food, clothing, shelter, relocation, rebuilding, all kinds of different stuff. And if you're not eligible for that relief, then, you know, the state has to do something to fill in the gaps in services.
So with that in mind, what could this governor, I mean, is it too, I mean, obviously there's great tragedy here, but what could the governor do in the future to help in some way, shape, or form?
This governor?
Yeah.
Whatever he wants,
right? Like, you know, there's emergency funding that the state of Florida presumably has available for hurricanes and all manner of natural disasters. So it would be digging into the state constitution and state law to see what sort of constraints there are on budgetary expenditures in responding to a natural I guess it depends too. Is it a natural disaster or is it a man-made disaster? And I guess we're still trying to figure that out. But in the interim, when the people in your state are hurting, when they have nowhere to live and no food to eat, and it's on account of an unexpected event, you have a moral obligation to make sure that they are taken care of. And the power to do so.
The problem is this governor doesn't think that.
Exactly.
That's the issue. This man, and you know that, Sarah. I mean, this man will let people who are not what he considers to be real Americans die. He doesn't really care.
With that, let us take a break. We'll come back and continue our conversation. We have many more issues to discuss, and we will do so. Our wonderful panel this morning, made up of Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. You can join us. All you have to do is write to us. The address is panel@wamc.org. Keep your letters short and to the point and on topic. Don't use links or attachments and abbreviations, and proofread your emails before you send. I know that seems like a lot, but it's really not that hard. Just pre-read, basically, and you'll be in good shape. panel@wamc.org. We will be right back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. I don't know about you, but it feels like a Monday morning, doesn't it? We welcome you.
Is that good or bad?
I don't know. It was nice. It's just been mellow. We're sort of mellow in here, talking about stuff. And
Sunday nights are what I don't like very much because the space program has something called re-entry expediters. See? So by the time you get to Sunday night, you got to be thinking about, you know.
Reentry.
Response to that reentry, right.
We welcome your reentry into our broadcast day. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's do this. The Pope sends more mixed messages on LGBTQ rights. An encouraging note from Pope Francis capped an especially disorienting week on the Vatican's stand toward gay rights. A leader in the Roman Catholic Church's efforts to reach out to the LGBTQ Catholics revealed on Sunday that Pope Francis has sent him a deeply encouraging note, capping an especially disorienting week. On Tuesday, the Vatican confirmed that it had tried to influence the affairs of the Italian state by expressing grave concerns about legislation currently in Parliament that increases protections for LGBTQ people. And days later, the Vatican's second-in-command insisted the church had nothing against gay rights but was protecting itself from leaving the church's core beliefs open to criminal charges of discrimination. You have to explain that one to me, Libby.
Okay.
Nearly 8 years after Pope Francis famously responded, "Who am I to judge on the issue of gay Catholics?" it has become increasingly difficult to discern where he stands on the issue. A growing dissonance has developed between his inclusive language and the church's actions. So what I take from that as a ever-practicing Catholic is that there's how the Pope feels and there's how the church has treated those in the LGBTQ population over the past however many centuries. The result is confusion and frustration among some of the people's liberal supporters, liberal supporters, thank you, Libby, who wonder whether the 84-year-old Argentine remains committed to a more tolerant church and is simply struggling to grasp the rapidly shifting contours of a difficult issue, or is it really a social conservative trying just to please everyone? Do you want this one first?
Sure. You know, this particular Pope, Pope Francis, has been, as we see here, better on LGBTQ issues. He's been more receptive. He sees us as human beings. I think he sees the duplicity in going after LGBTQ people and supporting pedophiles. I mean, you know, it's like, he understands, I think, that the church is not in a position to cast aspersions around someone's sexual orientation when they hid pedophiles for so many years who victimized children. And I'm not. And just to be clear, I am in no way equating the LGBTQ community, which is my community, with pedophilia. So let's just be, and that we do not recruit. So let's just be clear about that, because that's a new old trope that the right is using again, that
right.
we recruit. And it's like,
I'm no. sorry, Libby, I know I'm slow, but what do you mean recruit?
You know, the reason why we couldn't have gay teachers was because we were going to recruit the youngins to be gay.
Oh, I see.
Okay. That was one of the tropes from the 60s and 70s, and Anita Bryant. But, you know, the issue here about...
It's fun to hear you say youngins.
Yeah, I know. Believe me.
Go ahead. I know.
But the issue here, and the other two lawyers on the call can correct me if I'm wrong about this, since I don't even play one on TV, is that most of these kinds of laws around the world, I know at least in this country, exempt religious institutions. And so I would assume that Italy, if they passed this bill adding sexual orientation to a protected class, would exempt religious institutions just like everybody else does. And you know, the Supreme Court a week and a half ago really reaffirmed that when they said it was okay for the Philadelphia Church to discriminate against gay couples in foster care and adoption. So, you know, so I think their argument around this is ridiculous. You know, the idea that the church's core beliefs would be open to criminal charges of discrimination, you know, it has to do with how the bill is written, and I have a feeling that Italy would protect the church and religious freedom, or what they consider to be religious freedom. The real question here is that what's going on in the church, and the fact that you have a more liberal pope, one that a lot of people have not been comfortable with from the get-go, who really wanted to open up the church, who recognizes the fallacies of keeping people out. You know, he wrote this lovely note to this guy who did a workshop on how to bring more LGBT people into the church.
Father Martin.
Yeah, Father Martin. I mean, you know, they recognize that they need to bring folks in because they're losing folks by, you know, the shepherdful, or the herdful. So, you know, this church, the Catholic Church and the way it's structured and the hierarchy there, you still have people like Ratzenberger, who was the head.
Ratzenberger, that's wrong. You're here in Albany?
No.
Ratzenberger.
You know, who was the head of the Committee for the Propagation of the Faith, which is this incredibly conservative faction that basically gives everybody their marching orders. And it definitely is, you know, in conflict with what we see coming from the Pope. And, you know, the Pope comes from that liberation theology of the 60s and 70s that the Phil Berrigans of the world that spoke to so many people about taking care of the poor, making sure people had food and a roof over their heads, and wading into political things when oppression was not what was supposed to be happening, and he's running headlong into a wall, and so, you know, I mean,
and he has problems with the American bishops.
Yeah, right, but the bishops have backed down on their
because he told them they had to,
right. But they have backed down on not wanting to give Joe Biden communion. Because I think, look, the majority of Catholics in the United States are pro-choice. And that would just totally, once again, be one more thing to undermine the credibility of the church. So.
Okay. So as far as I know, we only have Jennifer, you do not have a law degree that I'm aware of.
Oh, sorry.
I do not.
Okay. But...
But can have one.
If you want to use one that Libby bestowed upon you, you're more than welcome to. Okay. Sarah, what do you make of this?
Well, I don't know much about the Italian legal system in terms of how it works and the connection to, I think it's papal law or canonical.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All that stuff. So, you know, we're looking at I do know a little bit about church organizations and Christian communities, and it's tricky for the Catholic faith bureaucracy because what we do in Protestant and in many Protestant traditions is they just subdivide and say, okay, well, you know, in the Lutheran tradition, for example, there's the Missouri Synod and the ELCA, and there was one other, and then they merged. But essentially, the Missouri Synod is more conservative. The ELCA is more progressive. My father was in seminary during that, when that rift separation occurred. It was very dramatic and messy.
Yep.
And, like, the Catholic Church can't do that because they have a completely different structure, right? And maybe it's for the best because it forces the Pope to wrestle with these questions as opposed to just breaking off different chunks of the Catholic Church and saying, well, okay, if you feel more comfortable, you know, I was in Brooklyn this weekend and passed by a Presbyterian church that was actually founded in the 19th century by abolitionists. And they had a gay trans flag, you know, a pride trans flag, Black Lives Matter, then, you know, all of the truly, like, all of you is welcome here and everyone is welcome here symbols and messages, right, founded by abolitionists. And so, like, someone like me could say, oh, I know I want to worship there because, you know, they embrace it, my core beliefs, which I believe are also the beliefs and teachings of Jesus, right? Acceptance and all of that. So, you know, the Catholic Church doesn't have a way to send those signals. Different congregations do. And I know, Joe, you've talked about, you know, different. I'm in a little bit more in the dark and how that works in the Catholic tradition, but it seems to me that they're more restricted in terms of how to signal that to their congregants.
They are, but you find yourself church shopping where you know that there is someone at the helm who is welcome, and sometimes it can be simple as what you just described as a small sticker in the window behind the stained glass that says, all are welcome here. Mm-hmm. You see members of the church population who are in the LGBTQIA plus community who are running the Sunday school and are running and are working on children's programs, and gay couples who have been married within the church. So you know about that, and in many cases that, you know, that news obviously spreads quickly, and I don't think it's perhaps it's an open secret, but by the same token, you can drive 4 miles away to the next town and the next church that is as conservative mm-hmm. and as, what I would term scary, but also that, and by the way, I would also say, not to further muddy these waters, but look, it's a lot harder now. You know, you could, quote unquote, church shop a lot easier when there were more priests. Well, now, if you have one priest who is overseeing 8-9 churches in a county, that's really difficult. So, well, they're going on a goodwill tour. I mean, they have so few priests. If you get one at all, you're going to get one who's, you know, on the road. And that's difficult as well. While we are talking about the Pope, we should note, or when we're actually talking about LGBTQ issues during this Pride Month, we'll also note that the Supreme Court has declined to hear a legal battle over the rights of transgender students, handing a victory to Gavin Grimm. You may remember that name. He was the Virginia student who had the Virginia School Board deny him access to the boys' restroom. So the justices now have decided that they will not hear this case, which is then a win for the student. As is its custom, the court did not say why it was rejecting the appeal of the Gloucester County School District. Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito said they would not have accepted the case. The court's decision not to take up the case does not establish a national precedent. In a 2-1 decision last August, the Court of Appeals for the 4th District said the school board had practiced sex-based discrimination and violated the 14th Amendment by prohibiting Grimm, a transgender student, for using the bathroom that aligned with his gender identity. His high school offered a single-stall restroom as an alternative.
The bathroom issue is one of the most divisive, because what you'll get are the crazies on the right saying you're going to have men dress up as women just to be able to go into the women's room and terrorize women and girls. And, you know, it's like, give me a break. You know, we just want to go to the bathroom in peace. And I think that this will be, while it's not national in scope in terms of it, wouldn't make a final decision about it. And given last week's decision, I'm not sure how they would come down on it. But although that was religion, and this is just public accommodation, you know, this will have an impact on transgender students throughout the country, because their lawyers, if they are told not to use the bathroom, will be able to look at, you know, cite this case and say, no, you're wrong. I mean, we had a situation over the weekend where in New Jersey, of all places, there was a self-identified queer student who was a valedictorian giving their valedictorian speech, and he started talking about LGBTQ issues and mental health, and the principal took the microphone away.
Well, he rumpled up the speech. They cut the mic because they said he wasn't giving the speech that they had workshopped with the people. They took it off, they rumpled it up, and they gave him the speech that they approved. And then at that point, he did the other speech by memory.
Right. And this happened a few weeks back at another high school.
Yeah.
Not about LGBTQ issues, I don't think, but I think about somebody talking about, you know, current affairs, and they didn't like what they were hearing. And so, you know, I think these students who had the mics taken away from them, you know, have a First Amendment case to bring forth.
You know, it's the fascinating case in New Jersey where the young student was basically shut up and yet finished. Two interesting things about that. One is the response from the student body that was so overwhelmingly positive and inclusive. So thank goodness for students. But also, if you look up the principal to see the scandals this guy has had in his past of dealing with the school board and all kinds of issues about people bringing guns to school and terrorist issues and so forth. There have been, I think there's like five different petitions on change.org to try to get rid of this guy. So there's that. But it is interesting that that those are the things that will kind of tap you on the shoulder and wake you up. Sarah, anything you would like to add to the Supreme Court decision?
This is why I love serving on a school board. It's like a microcosm of all of the up and coming important issues in our country. You know, diversity, equity, inclusion. That's where a lot of schools are focusing their efforts. The state of New York is asking all New York schools to focus their efforts on diversity, equity, inclusion. And that brings up all of these issues that we've sort of, you know, been, I don't know, I guess schools have always been a place where a lot of these battles are fought. First Amendment protections are really interesting in the school environment. And I guess, you know, on the bathroom issue, of course we should be accommodating trans students. And I'm delighted that the Supreme Court didn't take up the issue in order to issue some sort of nationwide mandate. But that's not something that they would do anyway. They probably, although I haven't read anything, any of the papers, the issue just isn't ripe for Supreme Court review at this point. They're going to need a lot more districts to weigh in, or circuit courts. You know, there's going to need to be a lot of different. I'm not suggesting that people there's a lot of litigation that needs to happen before the Supreme Court wades into these waters, I guess is what I'll say.
Okay.
And the precursor to all of that will be school board policies, superintendents, principals, and students pushing the envelope.
But lawyer Sarah, my question to you is, as an individual, as opposed to a lawyer, is where do you come down on letting there be, you know, multi-sex access to bathrooms? You know, this is a major issue everywhere. I would wonder what your personal feelings are on this.
I see it as a human rights issue. Everyone needs to be able to go to the bathroom. And so it's, you know, whatever your community decides, at Albany Law School, we have a gender neutral restroom. And it's easy enough to convert any existing single gender only use, and as many corporations are doing. Target has done it for a long time now. You know, it's not hard to figure out what works in your ecosystem for low cost. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it would be great for us to get to a place where we have private stalls that are, you know, all bathrooms are for all people and all stalls are private. The big issue, and I know this sounds crazy, but I've been in a lot of these conversations in a lot of different spaces, both academic and I've been following the corporate side, is really privacy, and that, like, the way that we've manufactured bathroom stalls leaves gaps. And so, like, it's kind of like a once the manufacturing and replacement of those stalls becomes easier, because privacy is also a universally accepted, like, fundamental right and freedom. So we have to balance all the freedoms and then just get manufacturing to catch up so that it's cost effective to maintain everybody's human rights while also allowing people to go to the bathroom.
Right. Which, you know, I don't want to, well, never mind, I won't go that down that road.
Thank you.
Well, what do you think, Libby?
Well, you said what you thought, right? You win.
I think people should be able to use the bathroom that they want to be able to use. I am not, however, a fan of walking into a bathroom and having men standing at urinals. And having
but that would be again, this is to Sarah's point about stalls.
Right. Yeah. Just stalls would be fine. Yeah. Absolutely.
You remember
how about stalls with gaps in them, as Sarah just mentioned?
Well, the thing is that, you know, you go into some airports now and the stalls are really very secure and tight, and the doors come almost all the way down because people were stealing people's bags from underneath.
Right.
And there are no gaps. So I think it is possible, and I think Sarah's right in terms of the redo.
Mm.
You know, when Allie McBeal was the first time I saw the the unisex bathroom, that always fascinated me. Okay. Jennifer, I want your input on this.
I am very frustrated by the conversations, not that, you know, not with our conversations today, but overall that we're focused on bathrooms still. Right. I mean, I know I can't stand the bathroom conversation because it's so linked to homophobia. It drives me crazy. And it's been happening for decades and it's ludicrous. I have a 9-year-old son and there are times where I have propped open the men's room bathroom door so I can see what he's doing in there. And men, of course, wait until I am finished and he is finished because he doesn't want to be in the women's room because he's a boy. And there's all these gender types and identity stereotypes that go with all of these things. It drives me bonkers. And what I will say here overall is that I really think a lot about when we're talking diversity and inclusion in the trans community, that it's not just about bathrooms. It's so far beyond that, because even in school, what we have to remember across the country is that there's a lack of opportunity. Trans students and gay students, still LGBTQ students, do not have the same opportunities spatially and educationally across America in schools, because they're either blocked from sports teams, or there's a debate on what locker room they'll be able to use or what bathroom they'll be able to use. They're often not included in the literature that's taught or read. So this goes beyond the bathroom. The bathroom issue is the distraction from the larger lack of equity,
yes,
and attention and focus and equality. So I'd like people to, you know, remember that it goes beyond that. It goes to lost opportunities. Like, oh, you can't go to the bathroom? Okay, well, you also can't play on the sports team. You can't use the locker room, and you may not be able to spatially go around other places in your school. You also may not be able to see yourself present or discuss issues that are affecting you, right, in your project or what's going on in the classroom for you to learn or for other people to learn. And that's also part of the bigger problem.
We are going to continue our discussion as we go on, and we'll be back for our last go-round with our panel right after this break from the BBC. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Okay, so let's go to, we have bathroom letters, so we'll get to those. Mary says many colleges already have gender-neutral bathrooms, even in dormitories. That is true, especially the new ones who are being built. Terry says, as a Catholic who is struggling and protesting the lack of inclusivity in the upper ranks and with the clericism that keeps the church as an exclusive club that accepts those that tick the boxes, heterosexual, married people, Jesus exclude no one from his ministry and message. The ones making the decisions are celibate men who have no idea what it is like to be in the real world and appear hypocritical when they cannot deal with the pain and crisis of the pedophile priests.
But how do you know this celibate?
Hold on.
Oh, sorry.
But will excommunicate a bishop who ordains a woman to the priesthood? That, by the way, the answer to your question, Alan, is faith. They need to open leadership to the women's religious, to the to religious women, I think is what they mean, and the laity for healing and balance to return the church. There are many amazing members of the global church who understand the need for change and who walk the walk of Jesus. Good letter. All right. Let's see. We go to this one from Susan. The Catholic Church has discriminated against women for centuries. There would be enough priests of the church would recognize the gifts of all people. I was raised Catholic, but I didn't want my sons to witness the subliminal message in church that women were less than good discussion. Oh, we got a letter I wanted to get to. I just did some research on this. Oh, yeah, here we go. Tom says, could Libby please confirm this? The recent poll I have seen is closer to 36% of Catholics who are pro-choice. Ms. Post is entitled to her opinions, but not her own set of facts. Please have her confirm the fact that Catholics are pro-choice. Okay, so I did the research.
And?
So you didn't have to.
Thank you.
Because we were talking about bathrooms during the break. We didn't want to stop that conversation. No. So the difference becomes those who are Catholic, who identify as Catholic, and those who are practicing Catholic. And if you look at those who identify as Catholic, 65% are pro-choice. Of the people who are practicing Catholics, it is closer to 40%.
Okay. And 40% for practicing Catholics is really pretty good.
But to the point of for people who identify and when they put that little box down
right.
as Catholic, that's yes. Then right. they will say, do you have a religious affiliation? Yes, I am Catholic.
Right.
Do you, you know, and then they will say, how do you feel about this subject? So
thank you.
To fill that, that is, by the way, according to a Marist poll.
Oh, at which is a Jesuit school.
There you go.
Which is run by a Jewish guy, Lee
right,
Marengoff.
Right, Lee Marengoff. He's a wonderful man.
We love Lee.
Well,
very
Steve
much.
Greenberg, you know, over at Siena. So.
Yes. Who did the church hire when they needed help? Okay. We go to, I know we have another letter here, and we have a lot of other stuff, too. Okay, I can't find the other letter, so I will. Oh, here we go. I'm sorry. The previous pope is Ratzinger, not Ratzenberger. Okay. I don't think you were talking about the pope. Were you?
Well, yeah,
Ratzinger.
Ratzinger. Yes,
He was the previous pope. Okay.
But before he was pope, he was the head of the Committee for the Propagation of the Faith, which is where their policy decisions come out of. And he really was pretty rabid about that.
Because Ratzenberger is Cliff from Cheers.
Oh, right. Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, my God. Let's get to other topics. And please. Quickly. So the Trump. Let me go to immigration here first. So Vice President Harris was at the border over the weekend, emphasizing her focus is on, quote, root causes of migration. The vice president repeatedly emphasized that her focus is on those causes of immigration during her Friday visit to the U.S.-Mexico border, an event that only came after Republicans continually criticized her for not making the trip earlier in her term. Harris, who was put in charge of diplomatic efforts to stem the flow of migrants arriving on the southern border, visited Guatemala and Mexico earlier this month. The U.S.-Mexico border has recently seen an increase in arrivals, and Harris advised migrants do not come during a speech in Guatemala. The vice president was criticized on both sides of the aisle, with progressive Democrat AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, calling her stance on migration disappointing, and Republicans beginning an uproar that Harris hadn't gone to the border since being put in charge of the diplomatic effort regarding immigration. Sarah, I'll go to you first, obviously.
Yeah, I'm in the disappointed camp. I also am disappointed in Republicans that they think sending the vice president to the border is going to do anything at all except appease their constituents. Because when you're talking about root causes, she's exactly where she needs to be, which is Guatemala and Mexico. Although what she should be doing is not giving a speech and telling people not to come when they have valid asylum claims, but working, and I know she was doing this, but working with the government officials there to get at some of these issues, systemic poverty, violence, domestic violence,
best practices to stem domestic violence, labor trafficking, all the restabilizing governments that we have had a hand in destabilizing, which is part of the root cause of migration to the United States. Standing at the border and saying things to people who are either on the U.S. side and don't want people to come in, or are on the other side and are asking and are knocking on our door for safety, really doesn't do much. It's not a good use of the vice president's time. But the optics, of course, have a whole lot more to do with it than anything else. A lot of her work on migration, if she's taking it seriously, and I believe that she is going to be done behind closed doors. Diplomacy, only of the tip of the iceberg of diplomacy is ever aired in public, and that's when it's done correctly. So I'm sure there's a lot happening behind the scenes, and I hope that there's a lot being done in terms of aid to these countries, foreign aid. We spend less than 1% of our entire budget, federal budget, on foreign aid all over the world. You know, we could bump up some foreign aid here and there and make a big difference in these countries. And then, you know, sharing best practices, international agreements around narcotics and terrorism and all the parade of horribles that you can think of, all the things that bad people do. Not bad people, but people who are doing bad things. So this is a much thornier issue. Of course, the Republicans are going to make it about the border because that's where the fear is to get people to the polls at the midterm elections.
Right. All right. We are out of time, but I want to thank everybody for being with us. I thank you so much, and a very good conversation on all fronts. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Really good to have you here. A great pleasure. Let me see. I want to coming up next is the Congressional Corner. I want to thank Libby and Sarah and Jennifer. Thank you all for being here. We will continue our conversation and go to the Congressional Corner right after this.